and that in return for all that is thrown at me and follow your vanity as I go along, I can throw bubbles back. If I don't brood over all I want, it's the better for me, and not the worse for anyone. If I'm a plaything for you giants, be gentle with me. Miss Mocha replaced her handkerchief in her pocket, looking at me with very intent expression all the while, and pursued, I saw you in the street just now. You may suppose I'm not able to walk as fast as you, with my short legs and short breath, and I couldn't overtake you, but I guessed where you came and came after you. I've been here before today, but the good woman wasn't at home. Do you know her? I demanded. I know of her and about her, she replied, Ramona and Joram. I was there at 7 o'clock this morning. Do you remember what Steerforth said to me about this unfortunate girl that time when I saw you both at the inn? The great bonnet on Miss Mocha's head and the greater bonnet on the wall began to go backwards and forwards again when she asked this question. I remembered very well what she referred to, having had it in my thoughts many times that day. I told her so. May the father of all evil confound him, said the little woman, holding up her forefinger between me and her sparkling eyes, and 10 times more confound that wicked servant. But I believed it was you who had a boyish passion for her. I repeated. Child, child, in the name of blind ill fortune, cried Miss Mocha, wringing her hands impatiently as she went to and fro again upon the fender. Why did you praise her so and blush and look disturbed? I couldn't conceal from myself that I had done this, though for a reason very different from her supposition. What did I know? Said Miss Mocha, taking out her handkerchief again and giving one little stamp on the ground whenever, at short intervals, she applied it to her eyes with both hands at once. He was crossing you and wheedling you, I saw, and you were soft wax in his hands, I saw. Had I left the room a minute when his man told me that young innocence, so he called you, and you may call him old guilt all the days of your life, had set his heart upon her, and she was giddy and liked him, but his master was resolved that no harm should come of it, more for your sake than for hers, and that that was their business here, how could I but believe him? I saw Steerforth soothe and please you by his praise of her. You were the first to mention her name. You owned to an old admiration of her. You were hot and cold and red and white all at once when I spoke to you of her. What could I think? What did I think? But that you were a young libertine in everything but experience, and had fallen into hands that had experience enough and could manage you, having the fancy for your own good. Oh, 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 they were afraid of my finding out the truth, exclaimed Miss Mocha, getting off the fender and trotting up and down the kitchen with her 2 short arms distressfully lifted up, because I'm a sharp little thing. I need me to get through the world at all, and they deceived me altogether, and I gave the poor unfortunate girl a letter, which I fully believe was the beginning of her ever speaking to Littimer, who was left behind on purpose. I stood amazed at the revelation of all this perfidy, looking at Miss Mocha as she walked up and down the kitchen until she was out of breath, when she sat upon the fender again, and, drying her face with her handkerchief, shook her head for a long time without otherwise moving and without breaking silence. My country rounds, she added at length, brought me to Norwich, Mr. Copperfield, the night before last. What I happened to find out there about their secret way of coming and going without you, which was strange, led to my suspecting something wrong. I got into the coach from London last night as it came through Norwich and was here this morning. Oh, 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 too late! Poor little Mocha turned so chilly after all her crying and fretting that she turned round on the fender, putting her poor little wet feet in among the ashes to warm them, and sat looking at the fire like a large doll. I sat in a chair on the other side of the hearth, lost in unhappy reflections, and looking at the fire too, and sometimes at her. I must go, she said at last, rising as she spoke. It's late. You don't mistrust me? Meeting her sharp glance, which was as sharp as ever when she asked me, I could not on that short challenge answer no, quite frankly. Come, said she, accepting the offer of my hand to help her over the fender and looking wistfully up into my face. You know you wouldn't mistrust me if I was a full-sized woman. I felt that there was much truth in this, and I felt rather ashamed of myself. You are a young man, she said, nodding. Take a word of advice, even from 3 foot nothing. Try not to associate bodily defects with mental, my good friend, except for a solid reason. She'd got over the fender now, and I got over my suspicion. I told her that I believed she'd given me a faithful account of herself, and that we had both been hapless instruments in designing hands. She thanked me and said I was a good fellow. Now mind, she exclaimed, turning back on her way to the door and looking shrewdly at me with her forefinger up again. I have some reason to suspect from what I've heard. My ears are always open, I can't afford to spare what powers I have, that they are gone abroad. But if ever they return, if ever any of them returns while I am alive, I am more likely than another, going about as I do, to find it out soon. Whatever I know, you shall know. If ever I can do anything to serve the poor betrayed girl, I'll do it faithfully, please heaven, and Littimer had better have a bloodhound at his back than little Mocha. I placed implicit faith in this last statement, when I marked the look with which it was accompanied. Trust me no more, but trust me no less than you would trust a full-sized woman, said the little creature, touching me appealingly on the wrist. If ever you see me again, unlike what I am now and like what I was when you first saw me, observe what company I'm in. Call to mind that I am a very helpless and defenceless little thing. Think of me at home with my brother like myself and sister like myself when my day's work is done. Perhaps you won't then be very hard upon me, or surprised if I can be distressed and serious. Good night. I gave Miss Mocha my hand with a very different opinion of her from that which I had hitherto entertained, and opened the door to let her out. It was not a trifling business to get the great umbrella up and properly balanced in her grasp, but at last I successfully accomplished this, and saw it go bobbing down the street through the rain without the least appearance of having anybody underneath it, except when a heavier fall than usual from some overcharged waterspout sent it toppling over on one side, and discovered Miss Mocha struggling violently to get it right. After making one or two sallies to her relief, which were rendered futile by the umbrella's hopping on again like an immense bird before I could reach it, I came in, went to bed, and slept till morning. In the morning I was joined by Mr. Peggotty and by my old nurse, and we went at an early hour to the coach office, where Mrs. Gummidge and Ham were waiting to take leave of us. "Master Davy," Ham whispered, drawing me aside, while Mr. Peggotty was stowing his bag among the luggage, "his life is quite broke up. He don't know where he's going. He don't know what's afore him. He's bound upon a voyage that lasts on and off all the rest of his days, take my word for it, unless he finds what he's seeking of. I'm sure you'll be a friend to him, Master Davy. Trust me, I will indeed," said I, shaking hands with Ham earnestly. "Thank you. Thank you very kind, sir. One thing further. I'm in good employ, you know, Master Davy, and I aren't no way now of spending what I gets. Money's of no use to me no more except to live. If you can lay it out for him, I shall do my work with a better heart. Though, as to that, sir," and he spoke very steadily and mildly, "you're not to think that I shall work at all times like a man, and act the best that lays in my power." I told him I was well convinced of it, and I hinted that I hoped the time might even come when he would cease to lead the lonely life he naturally contemplated now. "No, sir," he said, shaking his head. "All that's past and over with me, sir. No one can ever fill the place that's empty. But you bear in mind about the money, as there's at all times some laying by for him." Reminding him of the fact that Mr. Peggotty derived a steady, though certainly very moderate, income from the bequest of his late brother-in-law, I promised to do so. We then took leave of each other. I cannot leave him even now without remembering with a pang at once his modest fortitude and his great sorrow. As to Mrs. Gummidge, if I were to endeavour to describe how she ran down the street by the side of the coach, seeing nothing but Mr. Peggotty on the roof, through the tears she tried to repress, and dashing herself against the people who were coming in the opposite direction, I should enter on a task of some difficulty. Therefore I'd better leave her sitting on a baker's doorstep, out of breath, with no shape at all remaining in her bonnet, and one of her shoes off lying on the pavement at a considerable distance. When we got to our journey's end, our first pursuit was to look about for a little lodging for Peggotty where her brother could have a bed. We were so fortunate as to find one, of a very clean and cheap description, over a chandler's shop only two streets removed from me. When we'd engaged this domicile, I bought some cold meat at an eating-house and took my fellow travellers home to tea. A proceeding, I regret to state, which didn't meet with Mrs. Crupp's approval, but quite the contrary. I ought to observe, however, in explanation of that lady's state of mind, that she was much offended by Peggotty's tucking up her widow's gown before she had been 10 minutes in the place and setting to work to dust my bedroom. This Mrs. Crupp regarded in the light of a liberty, and a liberty, she said, was a thing she never allowed. Mr. Peggotty had made a communication to me on the way to London for which I was not unprepared. It was that he purposed first seeing Mrs. Steerforth. As I felt bound to assist him in this, and also to mediate between them, with the view of sparing the mother's feelings as much as possible, I wrote to her that night. I told her, as mildly as I could, what his wrong was and what my own share in his injury. I said he was a man in very common life, but of a most gentle and upright character, and that I ventured to express a hope that she would not refuse to see him in his heavy trouble. I mentioned 2 o'clock in the afternoon as the hour of our coming, and I sent the letter myself by the first coach in the morning. At the appointed time we stood at the door of that house where I'd been a few days since so happy, where my youthful confidence and warmth of heart had been yielded up so freely, which was closed against me henceforth, which was now a waste, a ruin. No Littimer appeared. The pleasanter face, which had replaced his on the occasion of my last visit, answered to our summons, and went before us to the drawing-room. Mrs. Steerforth was sitting there. Rosa Dartle glided as we went in from another part of the room, and stood behind her chair. I saw directly in his mother's face that she knew from himself what he'd done. It was very pale, and bore the traces of deeper emotion than my letter alone, weakened by the doubts her fondness would have raised upon it, would have been likely to create. I thought her more like him than ever I'd thought her. And I felt, rather than saw, that the resemblance was not lost on my companion. She sat upright in her armchair, with a stately, immovable, passionless air that it seemed as if nothing could disturb. She looked very steadfastly at Mr. Peggotty when he stood before her, and he looked quite as steadfastly at her. Rosa Dartle's keen glance comprehended all of us. For some moments, not a word was spoken. She motioned to Mr. Peggotty to be seated. He said in a low voice, "I shouldn't feel it natural, ma'am, to sit down in this house. I'd sooner stand." And this was succeeded by another silence, which she broke thus. "I know with deep regret what's brought you here. What do you want of me? What do you ask me to do?" He put his hat under his arm, and feeling in his breast for Emily's letter, took it out, unfolded it, and gave it to her. "Please to read that, ma'am. That's my niece's hand." She read it, in the same stately and impassive way, untouched by its contents, as far as I could see, and returned it to him. "Unless he brings me back a lady,"
said Mr. Peggotty, tracing out that part with his finger. "I come to know, ma'am, whether he'll keep his word." "No," she returned. "Why not?" said Mr. Peggotty. "It is impossible. He would disgrace himself. You cannot fail to know that she's far below him." "Raise her up," said Mr. Peggotty. "She is uneducated and ignorant. Maybe she's not. Maybe she is." Said Mr. Peggotty. "I think not, ma'am, but I'm no judge of them things. Teach her better." "Since you oblige me to speak more plainly, which I am very unwilling to do, her humble connections would render such a thing impossible if nothing else did. Hark to this, ma'am," he returned slowly and quietly. "You know what it is to love your child. So do I. If she was 100 times my child, I couldn't love her more. You don't know what it is to lose your child. I do. All the heaps of riches in the world would be nowt to me if they was mine to buy her back. But save her from this disgrace, and she shall never be disgraced by us. Not one of us that she's grown up among, not one of us that's lived along with her, and had her for their all in all these many years, will ever look upon her pretty face again. We'll be content to let her be. We'll be content to think of her far off, as if she was underneath another sun and sky. We'll be content to trust her to her husband, to her little children, perhaps, and bide the time when all of us shall be alike in quality afore our God." The rugged eloquence with which he spoke was not devoid of all effect. She still preserved her proud manner, but there was a touch of softness in her voice as she answered, "I justify nothing. I make no counter-accusations. But I am sorry to repeat, it is impossible. Such a marriage would irretrievably blight my son's career and ruin his prospects. Nothing is more certain than that it never can take place and never will. If there is any other compensation..." "I am looking at the likeness of the face," interrupted Mr. Peggotty with a steady but a kindling eye, "that has looked at me in my home, at my fireside, in my boat, where not, smiling and friendly, when it was so treacherous that I go half wild when I think of it. If the likeness of that face don't turn a burning fire at the thought of offering money to me for my child's blight and ruin, it's as bad. I don't know being a lady's but what it's worse." She changed now in a moment. An angry flush overspread her features, and she said in an intolerant manner, grasping the armchair tightly with her hands, "What compensation can you make to me for opening such a pit between me and my son? What is your love to mine? What is your separation to ours?" Miss Dartle softly touched her and bent down her head to whisper, but she wouldn't hear a word. "No, Rosa, not a word. Let the man listen to what I say. My son, who has been the object of my life, to whom its every thought has been devoted, whom I have gratified from a child in every wish, from whom I have had no separate existence since his birth, to take up in a moment with a miserable girl and avoid me, to repay my confidence with systematic deception for her sake, and quit me for her, to set this wretched fancy against his mother's claims upon his duty, love, respect, gratitude, claims that every day and hour of his life should have strengthened into ties that nothing could be proof against. Is this no injury?" Again Rosa Dartle tried to soothe her. Again, ineffectually. "I say, Rosa, not a word. If he can stake his all upon the lightest object, I can stake my all upon a greater purpose. Let him go where he will, with the means that my love has secured to him. Does he think to reduce me by long absence? He knows his mother very little if he does. Let him put away his whim now, and he's welcome back. Let him not put her away now, and he never shall come near me, living or dying, while I can raise my hand to make a sign against it, unless, being rid of her forever, he comes humbly to me and begs for my forgiveness. This is my right. This is the acknowledgement I will have. This is the separation that there is between us. And is this, she added, looking at her visitor with the proud, intolerant air with which she'd begun, no injury? While I heard and saw the mother as she said these words, I seemed to hear and see the son defying them. All that I had ever seen in him, of an unyielding, wilful spirit, I saw in her. All the understanding that I had now of his misdirected energy became an understanding of her character, too, and a perception that it was, in its strongest springs, the same. She now observed to me aloud, resuming her former restraint, that it was useless to hear more or to say more, and that she begged to put an end to the interview. She rose with an air of dignity to leave the room, when Mr. Peggotty signified that it was needless. Don't fear me being any hindrance to you. I've no more to say, ma'am, he remarked as he moved towards the door. I come here with no hope, and I take away no hope. I've done what I thought should be done. But I never looked for any good to come of my standing where I do. This has been too evil a house for me and mine, for me to be in my right senses and expect it. With this we departed, leaving her standing by her elbow chair, a picture of a noble presence and a handsome face. We had on our way out to cross a paved hall with glass sides and roof, over which a vine was trained. Its leaves and shoots were green then, and the day being sunny, a pair of glass doors leading to the garden were thrown open. Rosa Dartle, entering this way with a noiseless step when we were close to them, addressed herself to me. "You do well," she said, "indeed, to bring this fellow here." Such a concentration of rage and scorn as darkened her face and flashed in her jet-black eyes, I couldn't have thought compressible even into that face. The scar made by the hammer was, as usual in this excited state of her features, strongly marked. When the throbbing I'd seen before came into it, as I looked at her, she absolutely lifted up her hand and struck it. "This is a fellow," she said, "a champion and bring here, is he not? You're a true man." "Miss Dartle," I returned, "you're surely not so unjust as to condemn me. Why do you bring division between these two mad creatures?" she returned. "Don't you know that they're both mad with their own self-will and pride?" "Is it my doing?" I returned. "Is it your doing?" she retorted. "Why do you bring this man here?" "He is a deeply injured man, Miss Dartle," I replied. "You may not know it. I know that James Steerforth," she said with her hand on her bosom as if to prevent the storm that was raging there from being loud, "has a false, corrupt heart and is a traitor. But what need I know or care about this fellow and his common niece?" "Miss Dartle," I returned, "you deepen the injury. It is sufficient already. I will only say at parting that you do him a great wrong." "I do him no wrong," she returned. "They are a depraved, worthless set. I'd have her whipped." Mr. Peggotty passed on without a word and went out at the door. "Oh, shame, Miss Dartle, shame," I said indignantly. "How can you bear to trample on his undeserved affliction?" "I would trample on them all," she answered. "I would have his house pulled down. I'd have her branded on the face, dressed in rags, and cast out in the streets to starve. If I had the power to sit in judgment on her, I would see it done. See it done, I would do it. I detest her. If I ever could reproach her with her infamous condition, I would go anywhere to do so. If I could hunt her to her grave, I would. If there was any word of comfort that would be a solace to her in a dying hour, and only I possessed it, I wouldn't part with it for life itself." The mere vehemence of her words can convey, I'm sensible, but a weak impression of the passion by which she was possessed, and which made itself articulate in her whole figure, though her voice, instead of being raised, was lower than usual. No description I could give of her would do justice to my recollection of her, or to her entire deliverance of herself to her anger. I've seen passion in many forms, but I've never seen it in such a form as that. When I joined Mr. Peggotty, he was walking slowly and thoughtfully down the hill. He told me, as soon as I came up with him, that having now discharged his mind of what he had purposed doing in London, he meant to set out on his travels that night. I asked him where he meant to go. He only answered, "I'm a-going, sir, to seek my niece." We went back to the little lodging over the chandler's shop, and there I found an opportunity of repeating to Peggotty what he'd said to me. She informed me in return that he'd said the same to her that morning. She knew no more than I did where he was going, but she thought he had some project shaped out in his mind. I didn't like to leave him under such circumstances, and we all three dined together off a beefsteak pie, which was one of the many good things for which Peggotty was famous, and which was curiously flavoured on this occasion, I recollect well, by a miscellaneous taste of tea, coffee, butter, bacon, cheese, new loaves, firewood, candles, and walnut ketchup, continually ascending from the shop. After dinner we sat for an hour or so near the window without talking much, and then Mr. Peggotty got up and brought his oilskin bag and his stout stick and laid them on the table. He accepted from his sister's stock of ready money a small sum on account of his legacy. Barely enough, I should have thought, to keep him for a month. He promised to communicate with me when anything befell him, and he slung his bag about him, took his hat and stick, and bade us both goodbye. "All good attend you, dear old woman," he said, embracing Peggotty, "and you too, Master Davy," shaking hands with me. "I'm a-going to seek her fur and wide. If she should come home while I'm away, but that ain't like to be. Or if I should bring her back, my meaning is that she and me shall live and die where no one can't reproach her. If any hurt should come to me, remember that the last words I left for her was, 'My unchanged love is with my darling child, and I forgive her.'" He said this solemnly, bareheaded. Then, putting on his hat, went down the stairs and away. We followed to the door. It was a warm, dusty evening, just the time when, in the great main thoroughfare out of which that byway turned, there was a temporary lull in the eternal tread of feet upon the pavement and a strong red sunshine. He turned, alone, at the corner of our shady street into a glow of light in which we lost him. Rarely did that hour of the evening come. Rarely did I wake at night. Rarely did I look up at the moon or stars, or watch the falling rain, or hear the wind. But I thought of his solitary figure toiling on, poor pilgrim, and recalled the words, "I'm a-going to seek her, fur and wide. If any hurt should come to me, remember that the last words I left for her was, 'My unchanged love is with my darling child, and I forgive her.'"
This ends part one of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, narrated by Patrick Tull. The story continues in part two. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Books Incorporated presents Part 2 of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. Narrated by Patrick Tull. This work was first published serially beginning in 1849. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books Incorporated. And now, part 2 of David Copperfield.
Chapter 33. Blissful. All this time, I'd gone on loving Dora harder than ever. Her idea was my refuge in disappointment and distress, and made some amends to me even for the loss of my friend. The more I pitied myself or pitied others, the more I sought for consolation in the image of Dora. The greater the accumulation of deceit and trouble in the world, the brighter and the purer shone the star of Dora high above the world. I don't think I had any definite idea where Dora came from, or in what degree she was related to a higher order of beings, but I'm quite sure I should have scouted the notion of her being simply human like any other young lady with indignation and contempt. If I may so express it, I was steeped in Dora. I wasn't merely over head and ears in love with her, but I was saturated through and through. Enough love might have been wrung out of me, metaphorically speaking, to drown anybody in. And yet there would have remained enough within me and all over me to pervade my entire existence. The first thing I did, on my own account, when I came back, was to take a night walk to Norwood, and, like the subject of a venerable riddle of my childhood, to go round and round the house without ever touching the house, thinking about Dora. I believe the theme of this incomprehensible conundrum was the moon. No matter what it was, I, the moon-struck slave of Dora, perambulated round and round the house and garden for 2 hours, looking through crevices in the palings, getting my chin by dint of violent exertion above the rusty nails on the top, blowing kisses at the lights in the windows, and romantically calling on the night at intervals to shield my Dora. I don't exactly know what from, I suppose from fire. Perhaps from mice, to which she had a great objection. My love was so much on my mind, and it was so natural to me to confide in Peggotty when I found her again by my side of an evening with the old set of industrial implements busily making the tour of my wardrobe, that I imparted to her in a sufficiently roundabout way my great secret. Peggotty was strongly interested, but I couldn't get her into my view of the case at all. She was audaciously prejudiced in my favour, and quite unable to understand why I should have any misgivings or be low-spirited about it. The young lady might think herself well off, she observed, to have such a beau. And as to her pa, she said, what did the gentleman expect, for gracious sake? I observed, however, that Mr. Spenlow's proctorial gown and stiff cravat took Peggotty down a little, and inspired her with a greater reverence for the man who was gradually becoming more and more etherealized in my eyes every day, and about whom a reflected radiance seemed to me to beam when he sat erect in court among his papers, like a little lighthouse in a sea of stationery. And by the by, it used to be uncommonly strange to me to consider, I remember, as I sat in court too, how those dim old judges and doctors wouldn't have cared for Dora if they'd known her. How they wouldn't have gone out of their senses with rapture if marriage with Dora had been proposed to them. How Dora might have sung and played upon that glorified guitar until she led me to the verge of madness, yet not have tempted one of those slow-goers an inch out of his road. I despise them to a man. Frozen out old gardeners in the flower-beds of the heart, I took a personal offence against them all. The bench was nothing to me but an insensible blunderer. The bar had no more tenderness or poetry in it than the bar of a public house. Taking the management of Peggotty's affairs into my own hands with no little pride, I proved the will and came to a settlement with the Legacy Duty Office and took her to the bank and soon got everything into an orderly train. We varied the legal character of these proceedings by going to see some perspiring waxwork in Fleet Street, melted, I should hope, these 20 years, and by visiting Miss Linwood's exhibition, which I remember is a mausoleum of needlework, favourable to self-examination and repentance, and by inspecting the Tower of London, and going to the top of St. Paul's. All these wonders afforded Peggotty as much pleasure as she was able to enjoy under existing circumstances, except, I think, St. Paul's, which, from her long attachment to her workbox, became a rival of the picture on the lid, and was, in some particulars, vanquished, she considered, by that work of art. Peggotty's business, which was what we used to call common form business in the Commons, and very light and lucrative the common form business was, being settled, I took her down to the office one morning to pay her bill. Mr. Spenlow had stepped out, old Tiffy said, to get a gentleman sworn for a marriage licence, but as I knew he'd be back directly, our place lying close to the surrogates and to the Vicar General's office too, I told Peggotty to wait. We were a little like undertakers in the Commons, as regarded probate transactions, generally making it a rule to look more or less cut up when we had to deal with clients in mourning. In a similar feeling of delicacy, we were always blithe and light-hearted with the licensed clients. Therefore, I hinted to Peggotty that she would find Mr. Spenlow much recovered from the shock of Mr. Barkis's decease, and indeed he came in like a bridegroom. But neither Peggotty nor I had eyes for him when we saw in company with him Mr. Murdstone. He was very little changed. His hair looked as thick and was certainly as black as ever, and his glance was as little to be trusted as of old. "Ah, Copperfield," said Mr. Spenlow, "you know this gentleman, I believe." I made my gentleman a distant bow, and Peggotty barely recognised him. He was at first somewhat disconcerted to meet us two together, but quickly decided what to do and came up to me. "I hope," he said, "that you are doing well." "It could hardly be interesting to you," said I. "Yes, if you wish to know." We looked at each other, and he addressed himself to Peggotty. "And you," said he, "I'm sorry to observe that you've lost your husband." "It's not the first loss I've had in my life, Mr. Murdstone," replied Peggotty, trembling from head to foot. "I'm glad to hope that there's nobody to blame for this one, nobody to answer for it." "Ah," said he, "that's a comfortable reflection. You've done your duty." "I've not worn anybody's life away," said Peggotty, "I'm thankful to think. No, Mr. Murdstone, I've not worried and frightened any sweet creature to an early grave." He eyed her gloomily, remorsefully, I thought, for an instant, and said, turning his head towards me, but looking at my feet instead of my face, "We're not likely to encounter soon again." A source of satisfaction to us both, no doubt, for such meetings as this can never be agreeable. "I do not expect that you, who always rebelled against my just authority exerted for your benefit and reformation, should owe me any goodwill now. There is an antipathy between us. An old one, I believe," said I, interrupting him. He smiled, and shot as evil a glance at me as could come from his dark eyes. "It rankled in your baby breast," he said. "It embittered the life of your poor mother. You're right. I hope you may do better. Yes, I hope you may correct yourself." Here he ended the dialogue, which had been carried on in a low voice in a corner of the outer office, by passing into Mr. Spenlow's room and saying aloud, in his smoothest manner, "Gentlemen of Mr. Spenlow's profession are accustomed to family differences. I know how complicated and difficult they always are." With that, he paid the money for his licence, and receiving it neatly folded from Mr. Spenlow, together with a shake of the hand and a polite wish for his happiness and the ladies, went out of the office. I might have had more difficulty in constraining myself to be silent under his words if I'd had less difficulty in impressing upon Peggotty, who was only angry on my account, good creature, that we were not in a place for recrimination, and that I besought her to hold her peace. She was so unusually roused that I was glad to compound for an affectionate hug, elicited by this revival in her mind of our old injuries, and to make the best I could of it before Mr. Spenlow and the clerks. Mrs. Spenlow didn't appear to know what the connection between Mr. Murdstone and myself was, which I was glad of, for I couldn't bear to acknowledge him even in my own breast, remembering what I did of the history of my poor mother. Mr. Spenlow seemed to think, if he thought anything about the matter, that my aunt was the leader of the state party in our family, and that there was a rebel party commanded by somebody else. So I gathered, at least from what he said, while we were waiting for Mr. Tiffy to make out Peggotty's bill of costs. "Miss Trotwood," he remarked, "is very firm, no doubt, and not likely to give way to opposition. I have an admiration for her character, and I may congratulate you, Copperfield, on being on the right side. Differences between relations are much to be deplored, but they are extremely general, and the great thing is to be on the right side. Meaning, I take it, on the side of the moneyed interest. Rather a good marriage, this, I believe," said Mr. Spenlow. I explained that I knew nothing about it. "Indeed," he said, speaking from the few words Mr. Murdstone dropped, as a man frequently does on these occasions, and from what Miss Murdstone let fall, "I should say it was rather a good marriage." "Do you mean that there's money, sir?" I asked. "Yes," said Mr. Spenlow, "I understand there's money. Beauty, too, I'm told." "Indeed. Is his new wife young?" "Just of age," said Mr. Spenlow. "So lately that I should think they'd been waiting for that." "Lord deliver," said Peggotty, so very emphatically and unexpectedly that we were all three discomposed, until Tiffy came in with the bill. Old Tiffy soon appeared, however, and handed it to Mr. Spenlow to look over. Mr. Spenlow, settling his chin in his cravat and rubbing it softly, went over the items with a deprecatory air, as if it were all Jorkins doing, and handed it back to Tiffy with a bland sigh. "Yes," he said, "that's right, quite right. I should have been extremely happy, Copperfield, to have limited these charges to the actual expenditure out of pocket. But it is an irksome incident in my professional life that I am not at liberty to consult my own wishes. I have a partner, Mr. Jorkins." As he said this with a gentle melancholy, which was the next thing to making no charge at all, I expressed my acknowledgments on Peggotty's behalf and paid Tiffy in banknotes. Peggotty then retired to her lodging, and Mr. Spenlow and I went into court, where we had a divorce suit coming on, under an ingenious little statute, repealed now, I believe, but in virtue of which I have seen several marriages annulled, of which the merits were these. The husband, whose name was Thomas Benjamin, had taken out his marriage license as Thomas only, suppressing the Benjamin in case he shouldn't find himself as comfortable as he expected. Not finding himself as comfortable as he expected, or being a little fatigued with his wife, poor fellow, he now came forward by a friend after being married a year or two, and declared that his name was Thomas Benjamin, and therefore he wasn't married at all, which the court confirmed to his great satisfaction. I must say that I had my doubts about the strict justice of this, and was not even frightened out of them by the bushel of wheat which reconciles all anomalies. But Mr. Spenlow argued the matter with me. He said, look at the world, there was good and evil in that. Look at the ecclesiastical law, there was good and evil in that. It was all part of a system. Very good, there you were. I had not the hardihood to suggest to Dora's father that possibly we might even improve the world a little if we got up early in the morning and took off our coats to the work. But I confessed that I thought we might improve the commons. Mr. Spenlow replied that he would particularly advise me to dismiss that idea from my mind as not being worthy of my gentlemanly character, but that he would be glad to hear from me of what improvement I thought the commons susceptible. Taking that part of the commons which happened to be nearest to us, for our man was unmarried by this time, and we were out of court and strolling past the prerogative office, I submitted that I thought the prerogative office rather a queerly managed institution. Mr. Spenlow inquired in what respect. I replied, with all due deference to his experience, but with more deference, I'm afraid, to his being Dora's father, that perhaps Perhaps it was a little nonsensical that the registry of that court, containing the original wills of all persons leaving effects within the immense province of Canterbury for three whole centuries, should be an accidental building never designed for the purpose, leased by the registrars for their own private emolument, unsafe, not even ascertained to be fireproof, choked with the important documents it held, and positively, from the roof to the basement, a mercenary speculation of the registrars who took great fees from the public, and crammed the public's wills away anyhow and anywhere, having no other object than to get rid of them cheaply. That perhaps it was a little unreasonable, that these registrars in the receipt of profits amounting to £8,000 or £9,000 a year, to say nothing of the profits of the deputy registrars and clerks of seats, should not be obliged to spend a little of that money in finding a reasonably safe place for the important documents which all classes of people were compelled to hand over to them, whether they would or no. That perhaps it was a little unjust that all the great offices in this great office should be magnificent sinecures, while the unfortunate working clerks in the cold, dark room upstairs were the worst rewarded, and the least considered men doing important services in London. That perhaps it was a little indecent that the principal registrar of all, whose duty it was to find the public, constantly resorting to this place, all needful accommodation, should be an enormous sinecurist in virtue of that post, and might be, besides, a clergyman, a pluralist, the holder of a stall in a cathedral, and what not. While the public was put to the inconvenience of which we had a specimen every afternoon when the office was busy, and which we knew to be quite monstrous. That perhaps, in short, this prerogative office of the Diocese of Canterbury was altogether such a pestilent job and such a pernicious absurdity that, but for its being squeezed away in a corner of St. Paul's Churchyard, which few people knew, it must have been turned completely inside out and upside down long ago. Mr. Spenlow smiled as I became modestly warm on the subject, and then argued this question with me as he had argued the other. He said, what was it after all? It was a question of feeling. If the public felt that their wills were in safekeeping and took it for granted that the office was not to be made better, who was the worse for it? Nobody. Who was the better for it? All the sinecurists. Very well. Then the good predominated. It might not be a perfect system. Nothing was perfect. But what he objected to was the insertion of the wedge. Under the prerogative office, the country had been glorious. Insert the wedge into the prerogative office, and the country would cease to be glorious. He considered it the principle of a gentleman to take things as he found them, and he had no doubt the prerogative office would last our time. I deferred to his opinion, though I had great doubts of it myself. I find he was right, however. For it's not only lasted to the present moment, but has done so in the teeth of a great parliamentary report made, not too willingly, 18 years ago, when all these objections of mine were set forth in detail, and when the existing stowage for wills was described as equal to the accumulation of only 2.5 years more. What they've done with them since, whether they've lost many or whether they sell any now and then to the butter shops, I don't know. I'm glad mine's not there. And I hope it may not go there yet a while. I've set all this down in my present blissful chapter, because here it comes into its natural place. Mr. Spenlow and I, falling into this conversation, prolonged it and our saunter to and fro until we diverged into general topics. And so it came about in the end that Mr. Spenlow told me this day week was Dora's birthday, and he would be glad if I would come down and join a little picnic on the occasion. I went out of my senses immediately. Became a mere driveller next day on receipt of a little lace-edged sheet of notepaper, favoured by Papa to remind, and passed the intervening period in a state of dotage. I think I committed every possible absurdity in the way of preparation for this blessed event. I turn hot when I remember the cravat I bought. My boots might be placed in any collection of instruments of torture. I provided and sent down by the Norwood coach the night before a delicate little hamper, amounting in itself, I thought, almost to a declaration. There were crackers in it, with the tenderest mottos that could be got for money. At 6 in the morning, I was in Covent Garden Market, buying a bouquet for Dora. At 10, I was on horseback. I hired a gallant grey for the occasion, with the bouquet in my hat to keep it fresh, trotting down to Norwood. I suppose that when I saw Dora in the garden and pretended not to see her, and rode past the house pretending to be anxiously looking for it, I committed 2 small fooleries, which other young gentlemen in my circumstances might have committed, because they came so very natural to me. But, oh, when I did find the house, and did dismount at the garden gate, and drag those stony-hearted boots across the lawn to Dora, sitting on a garden seat under a lilac tree, what a spectacle she was! Upon that beautiful morning, among the butterflies, in a white chip bonnet, and a dress of celestial blue. There was a young lady with her, comparatively stricken in years, almost 20, I should say. Her name was Miss Mills, and Dora called her Julia. She was the bosom friend of Dora. Happy Miss Mills! Jip was there, and Jip would bark at me again. When I presented my bouquet, he gnashed his teeth with jealousy. Well, he might. If he had the least idea how I adored his mistress, well, he might. "Oh, thank you, Mr. Copperfield. What dear flowers," said Dora. I had had an intention of saying, and had been studying the best form of words for 3 miles, that I thought them beautiful before I saw them so near her, but I couldn't manage it. She was too bewildering. To see her lay the flowers against her little dimpled chin was to lose all presence of mind and power of language in a feeble ecstasy. I wonder I didn't say, "Kill me if you have a heart, Miss Mills, let me die here." Then Dora held my flowers to Jip to smell. Then Jip growled and wouldn't smell them. Then Dora laughed and held them a little closer to Jip to make him. Then Jip laid hold of a bit of geranium with his teeth and worried imaginary cats in it. Then Dora beat him and pouted and said, "My poor beautiful flowers." As compassionately, I thought, as if Jip had laid hold of me. I wished he had. "You'll be so glad to hear, Mr. Copperfield," said Dora, that cross Miss Murdstone is not here. She's gone to her brother's marriage, and will be away at least 3 weeks. Isn't that delightful?" I said I was sure it must be delightful to her, and all that was delightful to her was delightful to me. Miss Mills, with an air of superior wisdom and benevolence, smiled upon us. "She is the most disagreeable thing I ever saw," said Dora. "You can't believe how ill-tempered and shocking she is, Julia." "Yes, I can, my dear," said Julia. "You can, perhaps, love," returned Dora, with her hand on Julia's. "Forgive my not accepting you, my dear, at first." I learned from this that Miss Mills had had her trials in the course of a checkered existence, and that to these perhaps I might refer that wise benignity of manner which I had already noticed. I found in the course of the day that this was the case. Miss Mills, having been unhappy in a misplaced affection, and being understood to have retired from the world on her awful stock of experience, but still to take a calm interest in the unblighted hopes and loves of youth. But now Mr. Spenlow came out of the house, and Dora went to him, saying, "Look, Papa, what beautiful flowers!" And Miss Mills smiled thoughtfully, as who should say, "Ye mayflies, enjoy your brief existence in the bright morning of life." And we all walked from the lawn towards the carriage, which was getting ready. I shall never have such a ride again. I have never had such another. There were only those 3, their hamper, my hamper, and the guitar case, and the phaeton. And, of course, the phaeton was open. And I rode behind it, and Dora sat with her back to the horses, looking towards me. She kept the bouquet close to her on the cushion, and wouldn't allow Jip to sit on that side of her at all, for fear he should crush it. She often carried it in her hand, often refreshed herself with its fragrance. Our eyes at those times often met, and my great astonishment is that I didn't go over the head of my gallant grey into the carriage. There was dust, I believe. There was a good deal of dust, I believe. I have a faint impression that Mr. Spenlow remonstrated with me for riding in it, but I knew of none. I was sensible of a mist of love and beauty about Dora, but of nothing else. He stood up sometimes and asked me what I thought of the prospect. I said it was delightful, and I dare say it was. But it was all Dora to me. The sun shone Dora, and the birds sang Dora. The south wind blew Dora, and the wild flowers in the hedges were all Doras to a bud. My comfort is Miss Mills understood me. Miss Mills alone could enter into my feelings thoroughly. I don't know how long we were going, and to this hour I know as little where we went. Perhaps it was near Guildford. Perhaps some Arabian night magician opened up the place for the day and shut it forever when we came away. It was a green spot on a hill, carpeted with soft turf. There were shady trees and heather, and as far as the eye could see, a rich landscape. It was a trying thing to find people here waiting for us, and my jealousy even of the ladies knew no bounds. But all of my own sex, especially one impostor 3 or 4 years my elder, with a red whisker on which she established an amount of presumption not to be endured, were my mortal foes. We all unpacked our baskets and employed ourselves in getting dinner ready. Red Whisker pretended he could make a salad, which I don't believe, and obtruded himself on public notice. Some of the young ladies washed the lettuces for him and sliced them under his directions. Dora was among these. I felt that fate had pitted me against this man, and one of us must fall. Red Whisker made his salad. I wondered how they could eat it. Nothing should have induced me to touch it. And voted himself into the charge of the wine cellar, which he constructed, being an ingenious beast, in the hollow trunk of a tree. By and by I saw him, with the majority of a lobster on his plate, eating his dinner at the feet of Dora. I have but an indistinct idea of what happened for some time after this baleful object presented itself to my view. I was very merry, I know, but it was hollow merriment. I attached myself to a young creature in pink with little eyes and flirted with her desperately. She received my attentions with favour. But whether on my account solely or because she had any designs on Red Whisker, I can't say. Dora's health was drunk. When I drank it, I affected to interrupt my conversation for that purpose and to resume it immediately afterwards. I caught Dora's eye as I bowed to her, and I thought it looked appealing. But it looked at me over the head of Red Whisker, and I was adamant. The young creature in pink had a mother in green, and I rather think the latter separated us from motives of policy. Howbeit, there was a general breaking up of the party while remnants of the dinner were being put away, and I strolled off by myself among the trees in a raging and remorseful state. I was debating whether I should pretend that I was not well and fly, I don't know where, upon my gallant grey, when Dora and Miss Mills met me. "Mr. Copperfield," said Miss Mills, "you are dull." I begged her pardon, not at all. "And Dora," said Miss Mills, "you are dull." "Oh, dear, no, not in the least." "Mr. Copperfield and Dora," said Miss Mills with an almost venerable air, "enough of this. Do not allow a trivial misunderstanding to wither the blossoms of spring, which, once put forth and blighted, cannot be renewed. I speak," said Miss Mills, "from experience of the past, the remote, irrevocable past. The gushing fountains which sparkle in the sun must not be stopped in mere caprice. The oasis in the desert of Sahara must not be plucked up idly." I hardly knew what I did. I was burning all over to that extraordinary extent. But I took Dora's little hand and kissed it, and she lent me. I kissed Miss Mills' hand, and we all seemed, to my thinking, to go straight up to the seventh heaven. We did not come down again. We stayed up there all the evening, At first we strayed to and fro among the trees, I with Dora's shy arm drawn through mine, and heaven knows, folly as it all was, it would have been a happy fate to have been struck immortal with those foolish feelings.